every magazine reminds us that Africa is more and more the center of the world, but it also is the center of some of the best writing, I think, on politics as...
You need a mic?
Well, this is just a recorder.
Oh, I can't see the computer.
You can't hear.
Got some competition out there.
On top of everything else, as you can see, we're under battle too. This probably will remind you of your lieutenant in the infantry experience. But it isn't recording outside. Test, I think. Yeah. Well, we've come right to the subject, but I was about to say that you have paragraphs such as the following. It is no surprise that Mr. Mandela is a person of conscience and stubborn principle. The surprise is that he has emerged from jail as such a remarkably skillful politician. And then the analysis in the London Economist goes on to describe the political process as it will unfold. This is a process with which our speaker is intimately acquainted. Herman J. Cohen is Assistant Secretary for African Affairs. He was born in New York City, received all his education there, with a bachelor's degree from the City College of New York, Phi Beta Kappa. He did graduate work at American University. He served for 2 years as an infantry officer in the 2nd Armored Division in the Federal Republic of Germany. In 1955, he was appointed Foreign Service Officer in the Department of State, and to the present has held 7 assignments abroad, specializing in African affairs in Uganda, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Zaire, and Senegal, the latter appointment being ambassador to Senegal and accredited to the Gambia. From 1970 to 74, he was director for Central African Affairs in the Department of State. From 1987 to 89, was senior director for African Affairs in the National Security Council. He served twice in the American Embassy in Paris, and has been both Deputy Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research and Deputy Assistant Secretary for Personnel in the Department of State. He's received numerous awards, including 2 Senior Foreign Service Presidential Meritorious Awards and a Senior Foreign Service several Senior Foreign Service Professional Performance Awards. So it's a great pleasure to have Ambassador Secretary Cohen with us, and subject to a problem that did not exist 30 minutes ago, 40 minutes ago, while we should have a good discussion. We unfortunately don't control this group any more than Ambassador Cohen controls the politics of Africa.
I hope he has more influence than you do.
Look forward to a discussion of developments in Africa.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. I thought maybe I could just briefly give you our priorities in Africa, and then open it up to discussion to see what you're specifically interested in. We have a 5-point agenda for Africa under the Bush administration. And this is not an order of priority, it's just they're all equally important. In South Africa, we feel that we must have a very active policy of doing everything the United States can to bring about an end to the apartheid system and replace it with a a non-racial representative democratic form of government, which all South Africans will be equal. In the Southern African region, we have a policy of fostering economic integration, fostering cooperation among the countries, because we believe that the Southern African region could be the economic motor for the rest of Africa. Once the political problems are settled, and you have several political problems, you have the apartheid question, you have Mozambique and Angola, who are undergoing severe civil conflicts. So we want to have a very active policy in Southern Africa to try to bring about peace and economic cooperation there. A third point is the economic development dossier. And this is the policy that has been the most consistent over the years, and it goes from all the our administrations, from Democrat to Republican and back again. We feel that we have a role to play in bringing about economic growth in Africa. Our philosophy about how to bring that about has changed since 1960, but we consistently want to work very hard to bring about economic development and growth in Africa. Third, we have a priority for conflict resolution. There are a number of conflicts going on in Africa, such as Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, Mozambique, and Angola, which are normally considered internal matters, but we don't consider them internal because they generate vast amounts of refugees, they generate vast amount of suffering, and this is a major drain on international resources. The United States provides hundreds of millions of dollars a year in disaster relief and to help starving people. Now, we are very happy to do that. There's never been any argument against our doing that. But we feel that these major resources would be better used for economic development, and therefore we feel we have a role to play, a responsibility to try and bring about an end to these conflicts in Sudan and Ethiopia especially. So we don't consider them internal affairs. We consider them internationalized problems. And finally, we have the priority which we've assigned to a category called human rights and democracy. Now, human rights has been a growing political issue in the United States since the early 1970s, and it's become more and more important. And you'll find that in our foreign assistance programs in Africa, we do consider human rights as one of the elements in the criteria as to whether or not we give foreign assistance. So a country like Somalia, for example, where we used to have major assistance programs, have been reduced to virtually nothing because of human rights violations by the government of Somalia. And we worry about that in all parts of Africa. We are now in the process of disengaging from Liberia in terms of economic assistance and military assistance because of human rights problems there. Now, this has been a policy for the last 20 years, but more recently, we've added on to that a belief that the traditional one-party state in Africa is not really responsive to the needs of modernization and is not really democratic. Many of us who've worked in the Africa business for the last 30 years have said, well, the Africans have their own way of democracy in the one-party state, but we don't believe that anymore. We find that the one-party state really leads to corruption, absolute power, and it does not give the people of these countries any alternatives. When they're not satisfied, they have no method for changing their governments. So we are increasingly telling African governments that they too must conform to the trends of the world, like Eastern Europe, and to look toward democratization as a way of solving their economic and social problems. No, we're not making democratization a precondition for foreign assistance as we do for human rights, but I think that day will come very soon where multi-party democratic systems will be required before we can provide economic and military cooperation with African governments. I just want to say, now those are our broad categories of priority, and I just want to say a word about South Africa, because I know most people have that uppermost in their minds when they look at Africa. South Africa, we feel, has entered into a very fluid situation over the last 18 months. Both the white government power structure and the black majority have undergone a change of thinking over the last 18 months. On the part of the white power structure, you have an understanding and a real analysis that the future of the white community is totally bound up with that of the black community. There is such an interdependence that if the black community does not advance economically to come up to the standards of the white community, then the white community itself is doomed to decline and really disappear, so that the people of my generation, I'm 58 years old, are now saying, my grandchildren really have no future in South Africa, even though they're white, unless the blacks become like us. Now, this is a cold, hard analysis. It's not based on morality so much. It's a cold, hard analysis. And the only way to bring the black community up to the standards of the whites is to give them full, equal political rights. There's no other way of doing it. So the people in charge of the South African power structure right now, who are people in their mid-50s, who have recently taken over, have said, we must bring the blacks into complete political equality. And that means giving up power, because in a democratic system, the majority rules. And they are now working toward giving up power to the blacks. The black community has also undergone a change, because between 1984 and 1988, their policy was to take power by seizing it, by confronting the white power structure so that it would collapse and that they would be able to take over. Now, this was not successful because the whites had such overwhelming power of coercion that it was not possible, even with guerrilla war coming from the outside. So the current leadership of the black majority, especially Mr. Nelson Mandela, are saying that the only way they can bring about this transformation of South African society and bring about black majority rule is through negotiations, through a political negotiation in which the special needs of the white community will be taken into account, and there will be bargaining and trade-offs so that everyone will be a winner and no one will be a loser. So we feel that the entire landscape has changed down there, and we feel that our support must be for a negotiating process and to support all those people in South Africa who want a negotiating process. That is the mainstream of thinking now in South Africa. But there are elements on both sides of the spectrum which oppose negotiations. On the side of the white community, you have Conservative Party and people even further to the right of the spectrum who say that you cannot trust the black government. The whites should never allow themselves to live under a black government. Therefore, they should either perpetuate the present system or carve out a white state in South Africa. We oppose this. We think this is totally unrealistic and immoral, and we're in favor of what the mainstream of the white community now wants, is a transfer to majority rule with checks and balances and safeguards. On the black side of the political equation, you have people called Pan-Africanists, black consciousness people, who say that you cannot negotiate with an illegitimate power. the whites never had power legitimately, therefore one doesn't negotiate with them. One just continues the confrontational process so that power will be transferred without negotiation. We don't agree with that either because we think that is unrealistic. The whites will not commit suicide and they want a fair negotiation. So we feel that our policy is to support those in the mainstream of both communities who want to negotiate a settlement that will, in which both sides will be winners and there will be a new democratic society in South Africa. So I will stop now and open it up to discussion.
Who would like to ask the first question? Would you comment about the difficulty of trying to administer any country in South Africa where there are tribes that overlap the political boundaries? I have the impression that that's one thing that makes it very difficult, is the allegiance to tribes.
Are you talking about Africa as a whole?
Yeah.
Most African countries you're talking about. Yes. Now, this the argument that people will tend to vote along ethnic lines reminds me a little bit about New York State, where we used to always had to have a, if you're governor was a white Protestant, then your lieutenant governor had to be an Italian American, and the comptroller had to be a Jewish American. We used to balance the ticket, as they call it. But people tend to vote along ethnic lines in Africa, but that is not a reason why there must be a one-party state. That is the excuse given. They say, well, people will just vote for their tribal friend and they won't really vote for ideology or for policy reasons or for platforms. I don't think that's a fair criticism because even if people do vote for ethnic groups, there can be coalitions. There are very few countries where one ethnic group really dominates. I guess one good example is Zimbabwe, where you have the Shona group, which is about 66%, and they dominate, but you still have to have coalitions, just like anywhere else, I think. So I don't think that's necessarily an impediment to democracy, which is what people say. I don't agree with that.
Next question.
Yeah. The ANC used to at least pay lip service to Marxist ideology. I presume that's been modified in recent years, but if the ANC came to power tomorrow, what would its economic and political doctrines and philosophies be?
We've had very close contacts with the ANC over the last 3 years, and we find that the ANC, African National Congress, for those who haven't heard those initials, is a really an amalgam of many different points of view. The thing that unites the ANC is the fight against apartheid, the desire to end the apartheid system. In the early days, they were heavily influenced by Marxist ideology, and their executive board does have members of the Communist Party of South Africa inside the organization. In fact, when Secretary Baker met with Mandela 4 weeks ago in Windhoek, Joe Slovo, the head of the Communist Party, was in the room as one of Mandela's entourage. But some interesting things have happened. One is that the Communist Party of South Africa, which is slavishly devoted to Soviet, to the Soviet party line, is now saying Marxism is now obsolete and that what South Africa needs is a mixed economy with free enterprise and some government intervention. So the Communist Party influence on the ANC is now in our side, is really going toward our side of the spectrum. Secondly, many of the ANC younger people have been educated in the United States and elsewhere, and they are now saying that just blanket nationalization and Marxist ideology is really not what's good for South Africa. Some of the older people are saying we must nationalize everything. So the debate is now going on, and what we're planning to do is we're planning to have a democratization program in South Africa through the National Endowment for Democracy, money funded through Congress, which will help black South Africans prepare to assume positions of power in South Africa when apartheid is finished. And one of the elements of our program will be economic education. People should be exposed to all the theories and be able to see what's happened in all the rest of the world. And what we're telling them is, those of you who believe in Marxism, go to the rest of Africa where they've tried it for 30 years and see how it's failed. Go to Eastern Europe and talk to these people. Go to the Soviet Union and talk to them. And so we think that there will be an evolution, and they'll have some rational economic points of view within the next few years.
Next question. Yeah.
Is there some political competition between the blacks themselves in South Africa?
Yes, well, now that it looks as if the process of dismantling apartheid is starting, so the unity of the black community, which was designed to end apartheid, is now starting to manifest itself in political divisions. I mentioned before the Pan-Africanists, who say there should not be a negotiation with the white community. There should be continued armed struggle. You also have different political tendencies within the black community. You have the Inkatha movement, which tends to be centered in the Zulu tribe, which is 7 million people, which is a very large segment of the black population. They have traditionally been opposed to economic sanctions. They've been willing to work within the system, whereas the African National Congress has not been willing to work within the system. This has created long-standing animosities. So one of Nelson Mandela's major problems right now is to unite all of the different black groups so that they can negotiate with the government as sort of in a unified front. And I think they'll need at least a year to get there. That's why I don't expect real negotiations to start until 1991. Because after all, a lot of these political leaders have been in prison and they've been in exile. It takes a while to set up their structures, their offices all over South Africa, and to campaign for their point of view. So, you know, the black community in South Africa is just like any other community. The people have different points of view and they argue those points of view.
Yes.
So you are mentioning the problem of the one-party system in many of the African countries. In Liberia, I was there at a time when Mr. Kobek was still there. The natives had no rights. I assume that now that the natives have been interviewed, it is now a one-party system.
Yeah, well, the question is,
for the folks in there.
Yeah. The question was about Liberia. Prior to the present regime, you had a regime of what we call Americo-Liberians. These were the descendants of the slaves who came in the 1820s. They ran the country and did nothing for the native Africans who lived in Liberia. They effectively were colonialists, even though they had black skin. 10 years ago, there was a military coup in Liberia where indigenous Africans took power. Now, they too have been running the country as an undemocratic system centered on one ethnic group. So the Americo-Liberian ethnic group, which ran it for its exclusive good, has now been replaced by one ethnic group among the locals who are running it for them in a very undemocratic manner. And they are now engaged in major human rights violations on top of all that. So I think the point you're trying to make is that it doesn't matter if who is running it. If it's undemocratic, it's undemocratic, and that's, we should criticize them, whoever it is. Yeah.
Other questions?
If I could take us back to South Africa for a moment. Now that the white regime is moving in the direction of tempering and abandoning apartheid, the question of tactics arises. It was an issue at the moment. Has the time come to lift or reduce sanctions against the regime in South Africa? I guess the central issue is whether the regime ought to be punished because it hasn't done more, or rewarded because it has done some things that
right.
How do you react to this issue?
Well, the question is about sanctions against South Africa. Is this a time now to start relaxing them, or should we get even more, apply even more pressure? This is a major continuing debate in Washington. And we work by our legislation. And the legislation which imposed sanctions in 1986 tells us when we can start relaxing them. And the starting point is when the government of South Africa has lifted all those restrictions which prohibit normal political life in South Africa. It's not when this apartheid disappears. It's when they've lifted the restrictions on normal political life, that is, allowing political parties to operate, taking people out of prison who are there for political reasons, lifting the state of emergency, which allows them to arrest people without charge, lifting censorship regulations, everything that prohibits normal political life on the part of the black community. Well, the government of South Africa has done a lot of that already. All political organizations have now been legalized. Nelson Mandela and others have been released. Censorship has virtually been lifted. The only things left, the state of emergency is still in place, and a lot of political prisoners are still in prison. And I expect these two impediments will be eliminated by the summertime, by the end of July. At that point, the President of the United States will be authorized by legislation to relax sanctions. Now, he can do all of them, or he can do one of them, or two of them. Now, this is a very touchy issue. Some people in the Congress are saying the best thing we can do for the government of South Africa is not to add new sanctions. That is already a reward. We've already reached that conclusion with the Congress. Don't relax pressure until apartheid is really over with. Other people are saying the South African government has all this pressure from its right wing. As I mentioned before, these people who don't want to negotiate, who want to keep apartheid going or want to have a separate state. Unless the president of South Africa can show them that what he's doing can get international appreciation, then he really will be in trouble. So we should start relaxing sanctions at that point. This debate is still going on. And one of our problems is, in Washington, is the debate itself is divisive. See, just having a debate in Congress causes all sorts of animosities, and we have a lot of problems with Congress that go beyond South Africa. So we want to do everything possible to reach a consensus with Congress on what to do. And I think the consensus that is emerging is that we should make a gesture to the government, but only a gesture, and not relax the mainstream of sanctions until we see more progress. And as progress takes place, then we relax sanctions one at a time. The one agreement we have with Congress right now is that there should be no increase in pressure on the South African government. They have made significant progress. Therefore, there's no need to punish them for making progress. But the question is, how much do we reward them? And I think we'll reward them a little bit, and maintain the mainstream of pressures until there's even more progress later on.
Would you ultimately come to the point of having to measure the progress in terms of the kind of negotiation and settlement you have to deal with on two planes, namely, is it going to be one man, one vote, or some kind of group representation? I think that would be a burning issue. And the other one is, behind that, will be the kind of economic agreements that have to be worked out, who pays the taxes for the development, etc.
Well, the question is, how do we judge progress as being made in a negotiation? And the question is, political representation and economic modeling. The one man, one vote has already been agreed to. You could call one man, one vote universal suffrage. That's been agreed to. The question is, do you have pure majority rule or modified majority rule? I can't think of any democracy in the Western world that has pure majority rule, including the United States. And what the South African whites are now looking at is something like the U.S. Senate as a second house, where you will not have pure majority rule, just as we have the state of Wyoming has the same representation as the state of California, which is not pure majority rule. And in that, they would like to build in some safeguards for what they call minority rights. In other words, what the term they're using right now is qualified majority. For certain life and death issues, a 51-49% vote would not suffice to change things. It would have to be a much greater majority where the white community or others in coalition might be able to block change for a while. That's what they're looking at, a qualified majority for certain key issues like cultural life of the Afrikaners, Afrikaner-speaking schools, that sort of thing. So we're not frightened by the idea of a qualified majority, but the question is what kind. We do not agree with group veto based on race. In other words, we don't think the white community should be able to veto any piece of legislation. On the question of economics, you know, there's a vast variety of models that could be adopted. But the key thing for us is, will the blacks be able to control resources so that the imbalances created by apartheid can be redressed? So when you have $500 a year spent on every black child in school and $3,000 a year spent on every white child, can the blacks control resources so that can be eliminated, that type of thing? I've spoken to 11 cabinet ministers of the white government, and I asked them this question, and they all agreed, yes, we agree that the blacks should control the resources for that purpose. What we want to protect against is the destruction of our culture, which we don't think is an unreasonable demand. Yeah, you know, the question is, what about the black kinship tradition, where you take care of your family first, even when you're in the government? This has been a problem in many African countries, and the whites who oppose the ending of apartheid are saying, how can you expect us to live under that type of system, where black leaders would tend to, in effect, take care of their families rather than the nation as a whole? I think that's why democracy is needed, so that people can form coalitions and oppose that sort of thing. I think it's also important to point out that South African blacks are far more urbanized than blacks in the rest of Africa, and that they've gotten away from the kinship thing more than the rest of Africa, although it still exists. So I think what the blacks are saying is we want a truly democratic form of government. And it's only in a democratic form of government that you can avoid this problem, because in the one-party state, the people who run the party take care of their ethnic group first. And many people in Africa feel left out of their governments because they are not in the ethnic group that's in power. I can't see in South Africa any single ethnic group ever dominating power, because it's so diverse and there's so many different groups, and they have so many well-educated people, that I can't see that happening under a truly democratic system. But of course, you know, even in the United States we have nepotism.
Mandela has a couple of times complained about the action or inaction of the police, and on one occasion didn't he delay negotiations for that reason? To what extent does the government control the police?
I think that the police are loyal to the government, but there's a very important problem that they have. Until 6 months ago, the official line of the government was that the ANC is evil, the ANC is a terrorist organization, the ANC is communist, the ANC is the devil. When I was there in January, I put on the TV in the evening, and there was the chief of police of all of South Africa being interviewed, an Afrikaner named Vandermeer. And they were saying, well, what about the ANC? And he's saying, we can work with the ANC, we can let them back in the country now, we think we should be negotiating with them instead of fighting with them. Well, after all these years of propaganda saying that the ANC is the devil, the average white policeman on the beat, it's very hard for him to transform his mentality when the chief of police is now saying the ANC are a bunch of pussycats and we can negotiate with them. So there's a big gulf, a gulf between the leadership and the average policeman. And I spoke to the minister of police about that, and he said, we're now doing extensive training programs having every policeman come in for at least 20 hours of training to tell them that we're in a new political situation now and that we're going to have to work with the ANC and not against the ANC. I spoke to Bishop Tutu about that. He said, when I saw this interview with the police commissioner, he said, I didn't think I was in South Africa anymore. He says, I couldn't believe it. But you're raising a very good point. And it's going to be a while before the police can really recycle themselves. But I think it'll work.
Howard? I was interested to know if the outside capital is important in developing South Africa's resources. What activity has come on the part of the Japanese, who seem to be better off financially than any other
The question is, what about the role of outside capital in development of South Africa, or Africa in general? I think it's important to point out that this year, Japan will have more foreign assistance in Africa than the United States. I think this is a very significant development, and that's why I've been to Tokyo. Because we want them to coordinate their aid with the United States. And we think it's extremely important to have outside capital because there's not enough indigenous capital, although there is indigenous capital in Africa. Just as we needed outside capital in the early 1800s, Africa will need it. South Africa especially needs outside capital, and one of the reasons there's been a change of mind among the whites in South Africa is that outside capital flows have been stopped since 1984. There's been no capital flows into South Africa. There's been a net exodus of capital of $12 billion in 4 years, and this has really stunned the economy of South Africa. And it's been due to two things, economic sanctions by foreign governments and decisions by individual investors who see South Africa as not a good political risk. So this has really hurt South Africa, limited economic growth to about 2% a year, when they really need 5% a year. So what I'm saying is outside capital is vital, and we're trying to prod the Japanese into doing a lot more than they're already doing. Yes?
Colonel, there's somebody out here I recommend. Colonel Foote, you better come. We can't hear you any more than you can hear us.
I want to ask what the state of affairs in Ethiopia is hoping for, any kind of a peace settlement there.
What is the state of affairs in Ethiopia? Well, I'm very depressed about Ethiopia because both the government and the various rebel groups there, mainly in Eritrea and Tigray, are more interested in military operations and looking for military solutions than they are about a peaceful settlement or about humanitarian issues. The northern part of Ethiopia right now is suffering from severe drought, and the war is stopping the international community from bringing in needed foodstuffs. We've got it all right there in the area, ready to go, but the war is stopping us from going in. We're going in partially through back doors and various things. But both sides want to fight rather than allow the food to go through. So our diplomacy now is trying to plead with everyone to stop the fighting while we bring the food in. And if they want to fight later, they can start again. But we're very depressed, and it's a question of the Ethiopian government sees that the country of Ethiopia is being dismembered by various groups that want to get out of Ethiopia. And they have this fervent nationalism that says we don't want to allow that to happen. And the people of Eritrea are saying, we've never been given a right of self-determination to say to determine if we want to be in Ethiopia. And this war has been going on for 30 years. A big part of the problem is that the government in Ethiopia itself is totally undemocratic, totally totalitarian and authoritarian. And they are unable to come to grips with different points of view. So we've talked to all the rebel groups, and they say to us, as long as President Mengistu is in power in Ethiopia, we cannot agree, we cannot negotiate with these people. He's just totally intransigent. So their objective right now is to get Mengistu out of power and negotiate with the successor. Our objective right now is to stop the fighting and get the food in. President Jimmy Carter is trying to mediate between the government and the Eritreans, and he's not making any headway at all. So it's a very depressing situation there.
Just releases about Mengistu flirting with free enterprise and renouncing Marxism, which some of his former teachers once told me he didn't understand to begin with.
Right. Well, Mengistu opted for the Soviet model, to be very friendly with the Soviets when he came in. And now the Soviets are telling him, you know, there's a new Gorbachev's in power, and they're saying, we cannot continue to give you $1 billion worth of arms for nothing. And we're saying to you, give up all this Marxism and turn toward the West. This is the message they're getting from the Soviets. So Mengistu is saying, well, I better do it. And he's now turning to the West, but nobody believes him. Nobody thinks he's serious. The problem with Mengistu is not his economic theory. As you say, he probably doesn't know much. The problem with Mengistu is one-man rule in a very cruel, authoritarian manner. That's the problem with Ethiopia. They need a dose of democracy there.
What are his prospects for staying in power, you might mention?
The prospects for staying in power, he's very tenacious, he's a survivor, but a lot of people are hoping that his immediate entourage will get rid of him in the near future.
Getting back to South Africa, past, there was a very special relationship between Israel and South Africa in such deals and military concerns under that regime. What is the status of that special relationship?
The question is, what is the status of the special relationship between Israel and South Africa? When Israel, most African countries broke relations with Israel in 1973 because of the Sinai War. At that point, Israel was rather cool toward South Africa, although the South African Jewish community has a higher per capita rate of giving to Israel than any other Jewish community in the world. But when all African countries broke relations with Israel, Israel said, well, we've got nothing to lose now. We can upgrade our relations with South Africa. And there was very intensive military cooperation on technology, exchange of technology. And this continued until 1987, at which point the United States had already started to apply economic sanctions against South Africa. And we told the Israelis it's unacceptable for them to be engaged in military cooperation with South Africa when we are engaged in economic pressure against South Africa, because everyone will think that the Israelis are just surrogates for us. So we advised the Israelis to stop it. And the Israelis said that they would allow existing military cooperation contracts to expire, but would not engage in any new ones. Now, we find this not a good solution because contracts continue on for many years. And we've identified very close cooperation in the area of ballistic missiles and jet fighters. And the Israelis are having a hard time getting out of this because it's very lucrative for them. And their defense industry depends a great deal on contracts from South Africa. So we and a lot of other members of Congress are leaning heavily on the Israelis. And we think they are going to allow it to phase out, but it'll take a number of years. And in addition, even if there are official contracts which are phasing out, a lot of Israeli technicians have gone to South Africa to sell their expertise there. So the cooperation continues, but it's taking another form. I do not believe there is any cooperation in the nuclear field. Conventional military, yes, but not in the nuclear field. At least we don't know about it if it is.
Yeah.
I was wondering to what extent sanctions in South Africa cause unemployment, how large was the unemployment in effect?
The question is, did sanctions cause unemployment in South Africa? Our estimate is that sanctions have not caused businesses to go out of business and therefore have unemployment. That has not happened. But what sanctions have done have caused economic growth to retract. When you have a natural increase in population of 3%, which is very large, hundreds of thousands of young people coming on the labor market every year, the natural expansion of economic opportunities is not taking place because of sanctions. So the unemployment is manifesting itself in young people not getting jobs. That's where it's hitting. But it's not causing people to lose their jobs. But the fact that a lot of young people are not getting jobs has a political impact, because these young people become very radicalized. And they are listening more to the argument that you shouldn't negotiate with an illegitimate regime than they're listening to Mandela, who says, let's negotiate.
The young people don't blame it on the government.
They do blame it on the government, yeah. And that's why they say they must confront the government. But they don't blame it on sanctions, no.
and some degree on capitalism as well.
Yeah, they say this is capitalism, the system is not giving us jobs, therefore we need to nationalize everything. So sanctions have had that effect on employment. I believe the per capita income of the black community is about $2,000 a year, which is much higher, than the rest of Africa, which is running anywhere from $1,000 down. However, the South African urbanized blacks are much higher than that, and you have vast areas of abject poverty in the South African rural areas. You have millions of South African blacks who are well below that line, the poverty line. But it's the South African urban blacks that lift the average to about 2,000 a year, which is the highest in Africa. The ANC is unsuccessful in mobilizing the youthful elements. That's a difficult question. Well, first of all, the ANC does have young people in it. The ANC, even the exiles, has people in their upper 30s and low 40s. So I think they will appeal to some of the younger groups. Secondly, the ANC is not the only organization. There are others. There are strong church groups. There is the labor movement, which is very powerful, which is affiliated with the ANC. So I kind of think, and also there's the charisma of Nelson Mandela and some of his associates. I kind of think they will succeed in unifying the black community. If they don't, what is the fallback? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the fallback is.
Affected at all by the shift of resources to East Europe and to Nicaragua and this whole changing pattern that Dole and others have been talking about?
Yes, the shifting of resources. Well, Secretary Baker has been talking about this, and one thing he's been saying is we are not asking to take money away from Africa to go to Eastern Europe. All of our requests to the Congress have been for supplemental money. For example, there's a bill before Congress now asking for $1.5 billion, which goes for Nicaragua, Panama, arrears to the United Nations, refugees, what else? I think, and Eastern Europe. And all of this is supposed to come out of the defense budget, not out of the regular foreign assistance budget, which would take money from Africa. And I was present when Secretary Baker went up to the Hill to talk about this, and a lot of members of Congress, far more than I would have expected, warned him not to take money away from Africa. They said, if you want us to vote money for Panama and Nicaragua, you have to promise not to take it away from Africa. And the Secretary said, I agree with you. We don't want to do that. But of course, foreign aid in general is in deep trouble in the United States because people would like to see the money spent on domestic priorities. That's where the competition is. It's not from Eastern Europe. It's on domestic requirements.
You've been with the Foreign Service a mighty long time. In that period, you've seen the nature of policy change. When you began, we didn't have much of a policy change.
see. To what extent do you think this shift into internal affairs is a good thing, a permanent thing, and you foresee the day when South Africa will apply sanctions because against the United States because we haven't handled our homeless problem adequately or our acid rain problems sufficiently with their judgment?
Well, I think more and more the United States Congress is demanding accountability. I have to go up to the Hill a lot to testify about aid, and I'm constantly being hit. Why are you giving money to that dictator Mobutu in Zaire? The president of Malawi is president for life. How could you accept that? See, I'm constantly getting hit on that. And I think, and you were talking about Senator Dole, he constantly uses the term emerging democracies. It's emerging democracies that deserve the help of the United States. The meaning there is that a lot of African countries are not emerging democracies, therefore they should not get help. So I think there's more and more a demand of the American people that we use these criteria in our foreign assistance programs. Whereas when I began, the main criteria was, are we fighting communism? See, are we fighting Russian penetration of Africa? So it's a whole new ball game now, and I think it's normal. American people are a lot better educated, and they think about these things, and they say, we ought to fight, we ought to be for democracy, we ought to be for human rights. 1972, I was director of Central Africa. We had major human rights violations in a tiny little country in Africa called Burundi, where the ethnic groups were fighting and the Tutsis were massacring Hutus. It was almost genocide. It was getting to those proportions. And there I was sitting, and I didn't get a single phone call. The press wasn't interested. I didn't get a single bite from Congress. And I started calling up the press. And I got one senator, Senator Tunney, to make a speech. Nobody listened to it. Now, if they take one political prisoner, there were thousands of people were being massacred. Now, if they take one political prisoner, I get 20 phone calls from Congress. I get 6 newspapers calling me. So it's a whole new political atmosphere in the United States, I think.
Let's give the graduate students a chance to ask a couple of questions. Darren Clark?
Thank you.
You better stand up because you're against the wall.
I'll follow Miller Center precedent and ask one question with 3 parts. I recently wrote a paper on the Angola-Namibia Peace Accords, and I'm very interested to know to what degree the Soviets cooperated with us on that. Of course, to remind people that those accords led to the Cubans withdrawing from Angola and the independence for Namibia. I'm interested in how much the Soviets cooperated. I know Mr. Crocker, your predecessor, thanked the Soviet envoy in New York for their cooperation. Or alternatively, to what degree was it a case that the exhaustion of the local belligerents, that is Angola and South Africa, led to those accords? And then also, what possibilities are there for the superpowers to cooperate to resolve some other regional conflicts in Africa?
Well, I worked with Chester Crocker on these accords. I went with him on 18 negotiating sessions, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that the Soviet contribution was very important. They, in effect, told the Angolan government they were the main supporters of the Angolan government in terms of military assistance. And they said to the Angolan government, we are no longer able to continue this high level of support. We cannot afford it. And even if we did, you couldn't win the war against UNITA. The only way to go is to negotiate a solution. And you should negotiate it so that the Cubans leave and Namibia becomes independent. In other words, we think you should accept the American mediation and their proposal. And on that basis, the Angolan government agreed to negotiate. And as we were negotiating, we were the mediators. There was always a Soviet diplomat in the hallway. And when we had problems with the Cubans and we had problems with the Angolans, we would go to them and say, your Cuban friends and your Angolan friends are being unreasonable. We'd explain it to them. And the next day, invariably, the Soviets would say, we've taken care of it. So we couldn't have collaborated in a better way. Sometimes they disagreed with us, and they came back to us, and we changed our position. So the Soviets were entirely helpful and, I would say, almost crucial to this whole process. Can we collaborate now? We have agreed to try and co-sponsor peace negotiations in Angola between the government and UNITAL. And we're now waiting for an answer from the two sides. So we are still working together in the same pattern that we did before.
Any other questions from that side?
I'm curious, when you talk about the transition from a one-party state to a two-party state in Africa today, what do you think the new parties will be based on if they're not based on ethnic affiliations?
That's a very good question. I think Somalia had 38 parties at one time. When I was ambassador to Senegal, they had a constitutional requirement that there can only be four parties, maximum of four parties. Nigeria is now trying to experiment with a two-party system, in effect, where the constitution would limit everything to two parties. And the president of Nigeria is so worried that one party will be Catholic and the other one will be Muslim, or no, Christian, one Christian, that he's saying, in order to be one of the valid political parties, you have to prove that you have representation from every part of Nigeria. In other words, you have to get 20,000 signatures or something. There's lots of experiments going on to avoid the problem of having 25 parties or having ethnic-based parties, and people are trying a lot of different things. The two Nigerian parties, by the way, are being called Republican and Democrat. So it's hard to say. We can't prescribe what they should be, but people are actively looking for new models. Really.
Alice?
Well, I just wanted to say that, you know, as you said, the Somalis did experiment with democracy prior to the present ruler, and so did Sudan, but the parties were always based on religious groups or ethnic groups. So I foresee that it will take quite a long time before this is replaced with some sort of Western-style democracy, because it is this just happens to be the way that politics is organized in Africa. But as for Ethiopia, the Amhara, who have been the ruling elite since the time of Emperor Menelik, have imposed this type of authoritarian rule through the emperor, so that Mengistu is really just doing what has always been done, and they are trying to break the Amhara hold of the country.
I think what you say, you made some very good points there. It's going to be a while before they develop a truly African democratic form of government. And that's why I said before, we're not making democracy a precondition for our foreign aid. Human rights, yes, but not democracy. I think, though, in a few years we'll probably be doing that. And secondly, I think what you say about Ethiopia is right. President Mengistu, although they call him president, is really in the line of the emperors. He's really more like an emperor than he is as a president. And in fact, people tell me he now sits on a little throne. So it's the Amharic desire to maintain the empire in an authoritarian way that's really driving politics in Ethiopia.
And is it Mengistu Angola?
No.
He's an Amhara,
and actually his mother was a servant in Haile Selassie's palace. So a lot of this is just retribution.
Yeah, he's the son of a nobleman, of an Amhara nobleman, and an illegitimate son.
I wanted to ask, what evidence do you see of the Chinese replacing the Russians and being a divisive force for us in helping Africa, all countries in Africa?
We don't see the Chinese as playing an active role. They're so inward-looking now. In the 60s, they were very active in Africa. In fact, Chu En Lai went to Tanzania and he announced publicly, Africa is ready for revolution. And they were quite happy to contribute to revolution in Africa, but right now they're virtually absent. And they're too busy with their own problems now. They're no longer a force.
It costs a lot of money.
Yeah, they don't have the money to spend.
Colonel Foote, where do you consider the areas of greatest stability on the African continent? In what nations? Egypt, Morocco, or some? And to what extent can those countries make a major, play a decisive or important role in helping to cut down the fighting and all these other fellows?
That's a good point. I find it rather ironic that the United States spends more energy trying to solve conflicts in Africa than the Africans themselves. The Organization of African Unity is virtually dormant when it comes to Sudan and Ethiopia, Angola, Mozambique, and all of these conflicts that are going on. That's because they adhere to this rule of you don't interfere in internal affairs. We've thrown that rule out of the window, and we're interfering very actively. There's not much stability in Africa these days, mainly because of this democracy problem. More and more people are saying, we want alternatives. We want alternatives. We don't want that one ethnic group to rule forever. You know, we want our chance. So it's hard for me to point out islands of stability in Africa right now.
Do you think the United States has the major influence on most of Africa now as far as external?
No.
Or Russia or Germany? Or
I would say if you're going to make a hierarchy of external influence in Africa, I still think the French have to be the most. They have the biggest stake in Africa, a lot of investments. Their aid program is the largest. I said the Japanese are ahead of us, but they're ahead of everybody. And they still have considerable influence in at least 15 countries in Africa. The currency in these 15 countries is convertible into the French franc, and it's guaranteed by the Treasury of France. So that's a great source of influence. Yeah, and they have several contingents of troops vitally in strategic areas. The British are still very influential. And then the United States, I think, are the three big powers in terms of foreign influence. The Soviets are phasing out. They're still influential in Ethiopia and Angola, but very little else. The Japanese are putting a lot of money in, but that's conscience money. They don't attempt to exert influence. They just say, they see it more like charity, but they don't have much political influence in Africa.
Dean Miller?
On a completely different level, it's Earth Day 2 approaches on Sunday. Do environmental concerns figure as a factor on their own, or are they subsidiary to population problems or economic development problems? And I think fire with fuel problems and so on.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because as we were driving down, I was thinking of our five main priority dossiers for Africa, and I was thinking maybe we should add a sixth, which is environment. Secretary Baker has told me that this is a major thing for him, but he's thinking more in terms of the wildlife, protection of wildlife. But the loss of the wood, of the forest cover, is very, very disturbing. Because of the use, the average household uses wood or charcoal for fuel, and the Africans don't have a tradition of replanting the trees that are cut down. So a large part of our foreign assistance program is designed to get trees replanted and reforestation and alternate sources of fuel. And we have projects designed to get more energy out of the same amount of wood that is used. We have something called the Guatemala stove, which can be manufactured locally in a village, which gets 38% efficiency out of a piece of wood as opposed to 12% just burning it. So we're working very hard on environment, and it's a big element of our aid program.
Thank you.
Could you say just a word about education today? We had high hopes in the early 60s that through assistance to the more promising health delivery programs, for instance, rural health and so on, one could do something. And Nigerian International Agricultural Institute was established that some of us were involved in. And, but what is the state today? Are the universities independent? Are they moving ahead in some of these urgent problem areas?
Universities, the African universities.
Yeah.
African universities are not doing too well because of financial problems. Because we were talking before of economic models, and because so many African countries opted for the Marxist model in the early days, and most of them are now reversing course and are going for something else. But the Marxist model had the effect of reducing economic growth and reducing production, and therefore reducing national wealth, and budgets went down, and educational budgets suffered a great deal in most African countries. So I don't think there are many African universities now that have extensive research programs or outreach or extension services. It's all very, anything that's being done in that line is being done by the World Bank or the AID of the State Department of the United States government or the French. But African universities are very, very backward in that sense right now.
Mr. Gordon.
Would you comment on the role of the Peace Corps future?
Well, the Peace Corps in Africa is doing a fabulous job. Again, we're talking about the irony of the U.S. getting involved with conflict resolution when Africans don't. When you go to rural areas in many countries in Africa, you see a white person or an American of any color doing extension work or some sort of technical work, it usually turns out to be an American Peace Corps. People who are educated Africans who become agronomists or medical people, they tend not to go to the rural areas. They tend to stay in the capital city or other the urban area. So American Peace Corps are doing fabulous jobs. We had the president of Gabon in the country recently, and he was having lunch with President Bush. And President Bush said, "What is the Peace Corps in your country, Mr. President?" He says, that's interesting. I go to my home village once every 3 months. He says, the last time I went there, I saw this white guy there speaking the language better than I do. And I said, who are you? He says, I'm Peace Corps. And they're really doing fabulous jobs, and we're trying to keep expanding it as much as we can into new countries.
Mitch Ranieri.
What is the situation in Libya? We decided what has happened with that fire, what was the situation with that fire in that factory?
The latest we heard is that it's a fake. The fire was a fake. Mm-hmm. It was designed to get us to believe that it's been destroyed and therefore we don't have to bomb it. So we've determined that it's still there, it's still producing chemical weapons.
Chemical weapons.
Yeah.
Mr. Seaman.
The disease AIDS, is that a serious problem in Africa? And do they have any effective system in trying to control it?
AIDS is a problem in certain countries. One should not generalize about AIDS in Africa. There are vast regions of Africa where AIDS is minimal or non-existent. But there are certain countries, there's a belt across the center of Africa, Angola, Zaire, Uganda, Tanzania, where there's a lot of AIDS, and it's epidemic proportions. And this is mainly in the urban areas, which hits the elites, the educated people, and the leadership. So it's a serious problem in those countries. What's being done about it? A number of those countries are cooperating very actively with us in research, because where you have more AIDS, it's a more fertile area for research. And they're also cooperating with educational programs. a couple of countries still refuse to admit there's a problem. Zimbabwe is one of them. They refuse to count. They refuse to really admit. But countries like Zaire and Uganda are really actively working with outside help. And it's all heterosexual in those countries. And it is unfortunately hitting the elites.
Mr. Secretary, we've all admired your composure and calm and tranquility on McNeil Lair and other programs. We had no idea we'd expose you to another level of challenge, but once more, you've impressed us with that quality, and I suppose there is nothing more important. One of your predecessors, Dean Rusk, used to say, what's the test for a secretary or assistant secretary? And you probably heard him say, put the candidate in a room with 5,000 white mice and see what he does. Since we couldn't do that, and since we had nothing but lack of success, however much we've used sanctions and non-sanctions, threats and counter-threats, promises and inducements with our colleagues on the outside, why we unfortunately have had something we hadn't expected, but you've more than risen to the occasion, and we congratulate you and look forward to continued success in your work.
Thank you.